Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Thriving After Trauma, Stories of Living and Healing by Shari Botwin, LCSW. Narrated by Colleen Marlowe. Forward. Stories of Living and Healing by Dr. Joanne White. Trauma comes in many different forms and can haunt us and even debilitate us long after the actual event or events took place. Depending on the type of trauma, it can interfere with our relationships, erode our self-esteem, and even jeopardize our future successes in work and life. Unfortunately, trauma can lead to a premature ending of life if the necessary support isn't in place. A person may take his or her own life as a means to end the pain that's often endured in relentless, tormented silence. Who is better qualified to write a book about trauma and how to heal and thrive beyond the ordeal than Shari Botwin, a survivor herself of sexual abuse? She knows firsthand the sense of loss, the grief, the pain, and the long journey of coming back home to herself, healed and renewed, and able to help others in their own recovery and personal healing. Shari's book is a testament not only to her own strength in coming to terms with what happened to her in her early years, but to the many men and women she's counseled who have experienced a life trauma and to their strength and active commitment in their own recovery. Recovery, as Shari aptly illustrates, isn't overnight. Often people grapple with shame, guilt, and despair, and even check out by not remembering the event or by not fully participating in life and experiencing love, joy, or even relief due to what they've relentlessly withstood. Shari's goal is an admirable one and is realized in this book, whose mission is not just to help the many individuals and families dealing with trauma, but, as she says, to unite all of us, survivors, family members of survivors, bystanders, and helpers. How Shari, as therapist, witness, supporter, victim, and survivor herself, accomplishes this is a compelling blend of true stories from sessions with her patients and strategies to heal from guilt, shame, and the fear of loss. The chapters also highlight behaviors and techniques that foster intimacy, courage, and the ability to reach out to others for help and support, to be loved, valued, and respected without feeling undeserving or not being seen or heard. Inherent in the recovery process, as Shari so aptly demonstrates, is the often difficult yet rewarding road to finding the way back to self, to the place inside of wholeness and openness, to explore life with enthusiasm and joy, the ability to love and be loved, and to dare to pursue their own dreams and reap success and fulfillment in work, love, and relationships. Most important, as Shari and her patients reclaim their lives and thrive, is the development of an ongoing, loving, respectful, and nurturing relationship with oneself. Self-trust is not always easy to regain and is often eroded in the face of trauma. This is especially true if the mantra in one's head is one of undeserving or is laden with guilt or remorse. If only I could have done more, or prevented it, or responded differently, is a familiar and disturbing repetitive mind dialogue that hounds many survivors, bystanders, and those affected directly or indirectly by trauma. If only is illustrated in the case of one of Shari's patients, a soldier who endured post-traumatic stress. At the front lines of Desert Storm, he saw death and violence up close. What tortured him long after the war was the horrific experience of helplessly watching his close friend die right before his eyes. With no recourse to save or help his friend, his own inability to do so plagued him and haunted him for the rest of his life, until he faced and confronted the pain and released the self-blame. Throughout the book are numerous stories of trauma, recovery, relief, and healing from the different people Shari has worked with. A mother coping with the death of her son from a drug overdose. A sibling who witnessed her brother getting run over and the family's loss of connection that followed. A female survivor of domestic violence who freed herself from her abuser after being married to him for 25 years. A mother who had a horrific child abuse history that helped her teenage daughter report the abuse she endured to the police and other stories that move us deeply. Shari's account of her own healing sheds light on how one can emerge after devastating sexual assault from a parent whose role is supposed to be one of a protector and nurturer. As an adult, she proactively faced her own misgivings of being a loving mother and a strong role model for her child. One of the beautiful chapters includes testimonials from several individuals who endured trauma, hearing their heartbreaking stories as they bear their hearts and their vulnerability. Is touching and makes their suffering and their victory palpable and profound. Thriving After Trauma, Stories of Living and Healing, gives us tremendous hope and promise, not only for the people in the book, but for ourselves. We emerge stronger and more resilient because of it. I believe another takeaway is that we begin to better understand the depth of trauma and the long road to healing. This offers each of us the opportunity and the ability to feel more compassion and sensitivity to all those individuals confronting trauma or any challenging ordeal, including ourselves. This in itself is a precious gift of Shari's book. What I find most wonderful throughout the book is how each person fought with tremendous will and persistence to reclaim their lives or to claim their life for the first time. We feel their struggle and their pain, and we are also present for their self-renewal and their victories as though they were our own. We also come away with tools to help us handle our own challenges, and we are better equipped to offer our support to others. By our immersion in this book, we become more humanized by the total experience. Dr. Joanne White is a number one international bestseller, award-winning author, speaker, certified coach and consultant, an energy master teacher who holistically transforms lives and businesses to success and wellness. Dr. White is also the founder of the Power Your Life Network, an executive host and producer of the Power Your Life shows. www.drjoannewhite.com. Introduction. While most kids were skipping around during recess, I was usually standing against the school's brick wall trying to figure out why I felt like such a misfit. I knew something was really wrong, but had no words or way to understand my experiences and feelings. From the age of 5, I felt depressed and hopeless and could not relate to the smiles and laughter of my young peers. I just remember standing on that playground as a 10-year-old child, telling myself, "Someday you'll find a way to tell the world what is happening to you." For the first 23 years of my life, I lived in an abusive family environment. All of this abuse was awful. It took place when I was asleep. I have many memories, which I buried for years, of waking up feeling like something horrible had happened to me the night before. On countless occasions, I would sit in front of a mirror with my eyes filled with tears, but could not understand why I was crying and in so much emotional agony. I felt ugly, afraid, distrusting, and hopeless. Starting in kindergarten, I looked to food for comfort and relationships outside of my family to feel loved. For years, I sat in front of the television watching sitcoms about perfect families, such as Little House on the Prairie and The Brady Bunch, and dreamed of the happy life I wished I had. I was terrified to go to school. I was built like an athlete or a dancer, and kids would say things like "thunder thighs" or call me "Big Butt Botwin." I was constantly being made fun of for being fat. I was so vulnerable, a people pleaser, and I had no interest in normal kid-like activities. I was the outsider looking in. When other kids talked about what they did on the weekends, I would listen and try to imagine the kinds of parents I wanted to live with. I fantasized about having a mom who would hug me and wipe away my tears, and a dad who would protect me and stand up for me when other kids bullied me. When the principal would make an announcement during the school day, I hoped she would call me down to the office and introduce me to my new family. Over and over, I was disappointed that this never happened in real life. Early in my childhood, I discovered my love for dance and theater. I began performing on stage when I was 9. What a lifesaver that was! Performing became an outlet for me to express some of my grief and anger. Every time I booked a role in a community musical, I felt hopeful because I proved to myself that if I wanted something and believed in myself, my dreams could come true. I remember playing the role of Frenchie in the show Grease at my high school and feeling like, Oh, this is what my life could be like if I had friends I could trust. I felt safe on that stage because no one could hurt me the way I was being hurt at home. As I became a teenager, my world became even darker and more full of despair. I was developing into a woman's body, and I began getting more attention from boys. When I walked down the hallways in middle school and high school, I found myself looking at the floor or looking through people versus at them. I was terrified of someone noticing me or making any reference to my blossoming figure. I was also afraid of being raped, but I could not figure out why I was so afraid of something I believed had never happened to me. Rather than look at my fears, I found ways to stay quiet and remain in denial. I would not allow myself to know the truth about what was happening to me at home. Once I left for college, my depression and symptoms of PTSD worsened. I spent nights feeling hopeless and afraid, and at times I thought about suicide. In the fall of my sophomore year, I became ill after having a miscarriage in my dorm room. I was not able to admit that I had lost a baby from an unwanted pregnancy caused by my abuser. I told myself I had a crazy irregular period, even though I experienced contractions and other symptoms of a miscarriage for hours. And that was not the first unwanted pregnancy caused by my abuser. During my teens and early 20s, I suffered 4 more unwanted pregnancies that resulted in miscarriages. I never told anyone, not even the gynecologist I was seeing at that time, who would ask me, "Is there any chance you might be pregnant?" I would go see her to find out why I was gaining weight, not having a menstrual cycle, and experiencing nausea, headaches, and other early pregnancy symptoms. Each time she asked me about my sexual activity, I adamantly responded, "I am a virgin." I was committed to keeping my secret silent. The risk of speaking took over my mind and heart every time I had an opportunity to tell. As I got older and more independent, I began to recognize my ability to help others. In college, I met a couple of young women who suffered from anorexia and bulimia, and I was drawn to them because I was also struggling with similar eating disorder behaviors. Even though I did not start working as a therapist until my mid-20s, I had a long history of counseling others. Around the age of 12, I took on the role of mediator in my family. When fights broke out between others, I intervened and offered ways to restore the peace. I would stand up during dinner and say things like, "Can't we just respect each other?" or "Please don't say such mean things." In middle school and high school, my peers came to me when they felt depressed or taken advantage of sexually, or when they felt like no one liked them. I was like the group cheerleader. I would write letters filled with support to help my friends feel better about themselves. When I lost family members, such as my grandmom and my cousin, I would console anyone who was grieving. I still remember standing up at an extended family Passover Seder and reading a letter to honor my aunt who had passed away just weeks before the holiday. I had people in tears, and some of my cousins came up to me after the Seder and told me how I made them feel comforted and less sad. Teachers, friends, and family members would constantly praise my ability to show concern and love for others. After I graduated from Hofstra University with my bachelor's in psychology, I started working in the eating disorders field at an inpatient rehab. From the moment I began working there, I was struck by all the patients telling stories of how their eating disorder was a reaction to some type of abuse or trauma they suffered earlier in life. One day, I went running to my supervisor at the clinic and said to her, "These stories are freaking me out. They are telling stories that I cannot even imagine relating to." She must have picked up on my pain, and instead of dismissing my concerns, she told me to get a therapist. For 2 years, I sat in therapy once a week and told my therapist that my life was fine and that my family was supportive. We talked a lot about my work at the rehab and how I was feeling lonely and wished I had a boyfriend. On several occasions, I would ask my therapist, "What is wrong with me? Why don't I ever have a boyfriend?" At the time, she was trying to help me open up more about the shame and distrust I had in others, but she had no idea where those feelings were coming from. One day, after a session we had that focused on dating and intimacy, I began feeling the memories of my sexual abuse in my body. Hours after the feelings came up, I called my therapist in a panic. I told her that I remembered how someone who was supposed to love me went inside of me. The floodgates had opened and there was no going back. years of repressed memories and feelings surfaced. After I broke my silence about my sexual abuse, I spent 3 or 4 days a week in intensive outpatient therapy for 10 years to work through the trauma. I called my therapist often during the first few years of my recovery work, saying, "I wish I had never opened my big fat mouth." I often wanted to take back the truth and not deal with the upheaval of pain and anger. Yet there was a part of me that remained determined to plow through the worst of the therapy because I wanted to live a full life, and I knew that the only way to get there was to come to terms with my past. I was done feeling depressed and worthless, of feeling stranded and living in such isolation. I wanted to experience people loving me, not just be there to support and help others. I wanted to feel confident in my ability to set limits and not just do what others wanted. I wanted to date men. I wanted a family. Then, in my mid-30s, I was hit with another challenge. After being diagnosed and successfully treated for thyroid cancer at the age of 35, I wanted to create a family. After several years of working through the abuse, I felt open to dating and marriage. However, I had to accept that at that point in my life, I had not experienced a serious long-term relationship. I knew I was not going to be on Earth forever, and that it was time to take some risks and be vulnerable with others. My support system grew, and I developed close friendships with colleagues and peers. I allowed myself to explore intimate relationships with men. I was opening up and letting more people know about my abuse and the work I was doing to have a full life. Yet I still did not have a romantic partner. So after my 38th birthday, I sought out consultation with a fertility specialist to talk about my options of starting a family as a single working woman. I knew I needed to talk to the fertility doctor about my history of unwanted pregnancies from my abuser. Luckily, she listened intently, and she did not question the abuse history I shared and how I had gotten pregnant in my past. She ran a bunch of blood tests, one of which came back showing that I had a genetic clotting disorder. In order to have a healthy pregnancy, she told me, I would need to give myself daily injections of blood thinners to prevent a viable pregnancy from ending prematurely. Less than a year after I was diagnosed with a clotting disorder, I found out I was pregnant. I will never forget running around my condo shouting at my dog, Chloe, "Guess what? Mommy's going to have a baby!" All my supporters celebrated with me. For almost 40 weeks, I found a way to love my body and the miracle I referred to as baby Botwin growing inside of me. 8 years later, my heart leaps with joy when I watch my now second-grade son run around the playground at school. And every day that I have the honor of parenting him, another part of me heals. I have discovered that I am capable of giving love, even after not receiving it during my own childhood. I have found a way to grieve for the part of me that did not have a normal childhood, and also to celebrate the safety I can provide for Andrew. I have proven to myself that anything is possible, no matter how bad my abuse left me feeling. After I gave birth in 2011, the focus of my private practice began to shift. Instead of treating patients who were mainly dealing with eating disorders, almost everyone who came to see me was also reporting some type of trauma. Some were abuse survivors, some had lost loved ones suddenly, and others were survivors of natural disasters, plane crashes, or desert storm. In 2014, after 15 years of being in private practice, I wanted to expand my horizons beyond my office. I wanted to get myself out there publicly to share my story to help others. I had experienced so many moments of hope after parenting Andrew for a couple of years. I wanted to share with the world the hope that comes from speaking after childhood sexual abuse. I started writing features for the Philadelphia Inquirer or breaking stories related to trauma. After my op-ed on childhood abuse released for the Philadelphia Inquirer, I received emails from men and women around the country who were at a loss. They also expressed gratitude and told me that they were inspired and were going to ask for help. My heart leaped every time I got an email from someone in their 40s, 50s, or 60s who had suffered in silence for decades. I told them that it was never too late to heal. It is never too late to reclaim your right to live a full life. In 2015, I was sitting on my sofa watching the ABC 2020 interview and Dateline NBC interview with 13 of Bill Cosby's accusers. I could barely breathe as I listened to each of their stories of betrayal and hurt. The next day, I sat down and wrote an op-ed for the Philadelphia Inquirer. The day that article was released, I heard from some of the women who had come forward claiming Bill Cosby had drugged and sexually assaulted them. The time span of these allegations covered 30 years. I also heard from women who had not gone public about their alleged sexual assaults by Bill Cosby. My words regarding trauma and healing were being heard and validated by hundreds of other survivors. Over the last 2 years, I have spent hours outside of my office writing and giving commentary to media outlets on the latest sexual abuse scandal, mass shooting, or natural disaster like Hurricanes Harvey and Irma. I attended both Cosby trials and was in the courtroom the day Cosby was sentenced and taken away in handcuffs to state prison for a minimum sentence of 36 months. While all of these stories are different, there are many more commonalities. Survivors struggle with the loss. Survivors struggle with feelings of shame and guilt. Survivors grapple with fear of loss. Survivors find themselves feeling despair, and at times some of them want to give up. All of us try to find ways to live with our thoughts and feelings, whether we have been a victim of abuse, a survivor of a mass shooting, or have lost all our property after a hurricane. My goal for this book is to unite all of us, survivors, family members, bystanders, and helpers. No one walks away from trauma feeling the exact same thing. There are things we have in common and feelings we cannot comprehend. It is not about understanding exactly what someone feels or remembering every detail. It is about hope. It is about acceptance. It is about understanding the impact of our trauma. And it is about fighting for our right to live fully and freely, no matter how horrific the trauma or our experiences were. It is about feeling worthy and deserving of becoming parents, having intimate relationships with partners, becoming successful in business, or whatever other dreams we may have. 1. Trauma defined. What is trauma? Trauma can take many forms: physical, emotional, or spiritual. According to the American Psychological Association, trauma can be defined as an emotional response to a terrible event such as a car accident, rape, or natural disaster. Shock and denial are typical immediately after the event. One of the worst school shootings in American history occurred at Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado, on April 20, 1999. Two teens went on a shooting spree, killing 13 people and injuring at least 20 others before turning the guns on themselves. For about 1 week after the shooting, images of the shooters, victims, and family members of dead and deceased took over all media outlets. Immediately after the tragedy, schools across the country enacted zero-tolerance rules. Bullying or any acts or threats of violence were not tolerated. Days after the horrific shooting, the media stopped covering the story in the front pages or in first stories. Mostly it faded from sight over time. There was some commentary on different news channels about the impact. Very little was said about how all those affected coped as the months and years followed the event. On September 11, 2001, militants associated with the Islamic extremist group Al-Qaeda hijacked 4 airplanes and carried out suicide attacks against targets in the United States. It was the deadliest day in history for New York City firefighters. 343 of them died that day. Less than 15 minutes after one of the planes crashed into the World Trade Center, the South Tower collapsed. At 10:30 a.m., the North Tower collapsed. Almost 3,000 people lost their lives that day, and over 10,000 were injured. Everyone was talking about the events that unfolded that day. People were desperate to connect to family members who worked at the World Trade Center and the Pentagon in Washington, D.C. Phone lines were down for hours. New York City was on lockdown. Bystanders and witnesses were frantic as they could not reassure their friends and family they were safe. Life was never going to be the same for American citizens. For weeks, there were vigils set up for the pilots and passengers of Flight 93, California-bound. Passengers on that flight had learned of the events in New York and Washington via cell phone. A few passengers and flight attendants planned an insurrection. They gave their lives to protect possible targets, including the White House and the U.S. Capitol. Trauma therapists received an enormous number of phone calls from people asking for help, in coping with the aftermath of that deadly attack. For weeks, when people drove into New York City, the skyline had a black cloud hanging over it. There were reminders everywhere. Posters of missing people were plastered all over New York City. Media outlets were interviewing survivors, first responders, and witnesses. On every anniversary of 9/11, schools, offices, and government officials commemorated the event by having a moment of silence during key moments of the attacks. Family members attended different vigils and read the names of their deceased. People around the country and the world had a dialogue about where they were that day and how they would never forget. Occasionally, we heard from wounded police and firefighters about the aftermath of the trauma. They talked about being crippled by post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. PTSD is a psychiatric disorder that can occur in people who have lived through or witnessed a terrorist act, serious accident, natural disaster, rape, or other violent assault. Many of the people directly involved in the 9/11 attacks were writing and giving media interviews in which they were reporting symptoms of severe PTSD. They were having flashbacks, nightmares, insomnia, suicidal thoughts, depression, and panic attacks. First responders were leaving their positions because they could not tolerate the level of anxiety they were experiencing after losing colleagues and watching people jump out of burning buildings. Survivors who had lost friends and family in the attack were leaving their jobs and the city to get away from all the reminders. At that time, the media was giving a ton of attention to 9/11. Little was said about what happened to all those people who survived 5, 10, or 15 years later. When I started counseling patients around 22 years ago, topics like childhood abuse, domestic violence, and sexual assault were taboo. While the research at that time showed that a high percentage of females had lived through some type of assault in their lifetime, there was very little attention given to these people and their stories. Many of these survivors were having similar reactions to their trauma as those who had lived through terrorist attacks like 9/11. The world was shocked to learn about the report in the Boston Globe that over 130 people came forward alleging that former priest John J. Gagan had raped or fondled them when they were in grammar school. The sex abuse scandal allegedly went on for at least 3 decades in 6 greater Boston parishes. As the priest was facing 2 criminal trials for his sexual compulsion, many were asking why it took a succession of 3 cardinals and many bishops 34 years to remove the children from Gagan's reach. In 2002, the Boston Globe's Spotlight team, which included a team of 5 investigative journalists, uncovered rampant sexual abuse by the clergy in that district. They also reported that the priests who were accused of abuse were being removed and allowed to work in other parishes. The team's investigation earned them a Pulitzer Prize for public service. In 2015, a Hollywood production company bought the rights to make a film on the Boston Spotlight story, once the movie was made. Before it went into production, the producers and writers of the script were sent walking. No one wanted to buy the rights to a film on such a controversial and unspeakable subject. In early 2016, the cast and crew, real-life journalists, and survivors of the sex abuse scandal were affirmed as Spotlight won several prestigious awards, including an Oscar for the Best Film in 2015. Several of my patients with an abuse history saw the movie. Many of them told me that they were able to have intimate conversations with close family members and partners about the feelings it triggered in them. Several media outlets invited survivors of sexual abuse to share their stories with the public. Finally, victims of abuse in the church were getting the help they needed. On the other hand, were natural disasters, including Hurricane Sandy, and the climate around this story was very different. On the 5-year anniversary of the storm, news outlets spoke to survivors. Many of them reported that they were still haunted by the losses and images of the hurricane. One of the survivors reported feeling anxious and fearful and living in a constant state of doom and gloom. He watched the water rush through his home, and he told reporters he could not get the image out of his head. He told reporters he called his disorder post-traumatic Sandy disorder. He also told journalists that there were hundreds of others suffering with PTSD who were not reaching out for help. Post-traumatic stress emerges. Post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, is a mental health condition that is triggered after a terrifying event. In 1980, The American Psychiatric Association.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?